Hey, listeners, it's 2024, and we are so excited for everything ahead this year. If you haven't done so already, make sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get access to bonus episodes. We've already released 18 of them, and they come out twice a month. Plus, you can get access to ad-free episodes and our private Discord server to hang out with other members of the CashLack community. That's patreon.com/curbsiders. Paul, did I ever tell you about my uncle?
No, you did not.
So he has the heart of a lion, Paul. But that means now he can never return to that zoo.
All right, that's not bad.
Okay, thank you.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly CashLack Moral Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we are responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician. Applause, please. Applause.
Yeah. Thank you.
Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Paul, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for asking. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing well, Paul. We are going to talk about pericarditis, myocarditis, maybe perimyocarditis, myopericarditis.
I hate it so much.
We have a great guest who I'll tell you more about in a second. But first, Paul, would you like to remind people, what is it that we do on Curbsiders?
There is nothing that makes me happier. We are the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And Matt, why don't you tell us about who we're talking to?
We are going to have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Vivek Kulkarni, a clinical cardiologist and assistant program director for the Cardiovascular Disease Fellowship at Cooper University Healthcare. He is a general cardiologist who has a specific interest in medical education, nuclear imaging, and echocardiography. He loves the JVP exam. Who doesn't, Paul? Complex echo hemodynamics and teaching the next generation of doctors. So big round of applause for our guest, Dr. Vivek Kulkarni. So Vivek, first question, always the same for all our guests. Share with the audience a hobby or interest that you have outside of medicine.
I used to have a lot of hobbies, and now I have kids. But I like crossword puzzles. I like running. I like now spending time with my family, maybe watching 30 minutes of Netflix before I pass out at the end of the day.
What crossword puzzles are you doing? Are you doing New York Times?
Yeah.
And do you do this Sunday?
I try.
All right. I have no follow-up questions there. Good for you. You're a better man than I. And the other question that we like to ask our guests is, if you can just tell us a piece of advice or feedback that you've either gotten or that you give out commonly that you feel would be useful for our listeners.
Can I do two?
Yeah.
One piece of advice that I was given is that you can't do an A-plus job of everything, so you have to pick what's important to you. I'm still working on that one, but it's stayed with me. And then one piece of advice that I give to people a lot is to really think about how you are approaching problems to try to get yourself to get better at it. Don't wait for other people to tell you how to get better.
Fantastic. So, Paul, I think we should just get to a case because this is a big topic. I'm a little nervous about how many questions we have on this, and we're supposed to leave time for audience questions as well. So let's just get to the case.
It's going
to
go great.
This is a case from the prestigious CashLack Memorial Hospital.
By the way, I thought that was a real place for a little while.
Yeah, we had people asking us on Twitter for our ERAS number so they could apply. So.
All right, let's talk about the patient. So we have a patient who comes in to see you in clinic. She is a 30-year-old woman who's been having chest pain for the last week. She describes the pain as achy and occasionally sharp, worse with deep breathing and activity, and it's been getting a little worse each day. She has no significant medical history, doesn't take any medications regularly, although does note that she had a cold recently and took some over-the-counter medication for this cold. So this is a patient who's coming in with sort of undifferentiated chest pain that's been going on for about a week. You already know the topic of our talk. So not to lead the witness too much, but tell us sort of how you'd what your initial approach should be and sort of where you go from here.
I think that, you know, you want to rule out common things first. Is there any, you know, I'm a cardiologist, but I like to think, is there any other reason for non-cardiac related things? But then specific to thinking about pericarditis, the positionality of the pain is very important. Classically in pericarditis, the pain is much worse when you lay back. People don't often report that, but if you can, you can get it out of them by asking the right questions. So I'd probably spend a lot of time asking about that. And then, you know, again, common things being common, you want to make sure she's not having a pulmonary embolism. That's relatively common. Is she taking oral contraceptives? You know, those are relatively straightforward things.
What does your physical exam, as a JVP enthusiast, what would your physical exam look like for this person? I'm not sure I'm great at picking up friction rubs. That might be a big I'm understating that probably.
So there are some physical findings of pericarditis. Friction rub is one of them. It has to be pretty bad pericardial inflammation to hear that. And many people who have symptomatic pericarditis, you may not hear a friction rub. You may not hear it even in a quiet fictional office, but in a real hospital, your chances are even lower. And, you know, the other thing is a good JVP exam, which is always important, but especially in somebody with pericarditis, you know, you could see either just elevated mean JVP, but then also people can have Kussmaul sign and other things that's indicative of how bad the effusion is.
All right. Well, let's get some more case out there, Paul.
Sure. So on our excellent exam, the patient's heart rate is 90. Her lungs are cleared auscultation. She has a nonspecific harsh sound, we're calling it, over her left lower sternal border. Her EKG shows ST segment elevations in the precordial and limb leads. You perform a point-of-care cardiac ultrasound in the office and notice a small pericardial effusion. And then you're managed to get labs very quickly, apparently, and they show maybe a mild leukocytosis, an elevated CRP, and a normal troponin. So now we're truly leading the witness. So at what point are we allowed to make the diagnosis of pericarditis? We have all this stuff. We have the name of the talk that we're giving today. But above and beyond that, you know, what is the diagnostic criteria, and how do we actually definitively make the diagnosis?
You know, I think most of the time it's a clinical diagnosis made based on history exam and these sort of findings. If she has a history that's appropriate with positional pain with the right character, ECG changes are often nonspecific. I see on the screen here there's nonspecific ST elevation. Sometimes you get PR depression. Those are very supportive and often elevated inflammatory markers. I think for most of us, that's probably enough to call it a diagnosis of pericarditis.
Yeah, I think in real life, some of the cases I've seen, like, we weren't exactly sure, and the person, the workup doesn't go quite this smoothly. Is that your experience with these cases? Or are you, when you see a case of pericarditis, are you often like highly confident in the diagnosis?
I think it depends on the etiology. You know, a lot of times the same things that cause pericarditis can also cause pleuritis or pleurisy. And so then things get a little complicated because then patients have chest pain that they describe in different ways. The EKG changes can be a little more subtle in those cases because their symptoms are driven by pleural inflammation. It depends on what etiology causes that because they happen differently.
Can I ask you to differentiate? I think if I had a patient with chest pain who had diffuse ST elevations on the EKG, I would still probably lose my mind because I'm a coward. But I guess, could you talk us through some of the differentiators? Because the thing, what we're not specifically saying explicitly is that you don't want to miss like a STEMI. That would be embarrassing. So I guess what EKG changes, if you could just sort of review, are most characteristic of pericarditis versus a STEMI that we might be missing in the office, which would be embarrassing?
Sure. A STEMI, the ST elevations are typically regional. So only one anatomic territory has ST elevations, and there's actually ST depressions in the reciprocal anatomic territory. Whereas for pericarditis, it's common to see ST elevation in every lead. There are no reciprocal changes at all. PR depression is also a giveaway. If you compare the PR interval to the TP segments, which is the isoelectric point between the heartbeats, if the PR is a little depressed, that's you know, not a STEMI. So I think the EKGs do look pretty different from one another.
We made a joke at the beginning of this about all the different like terminology, myocarditis, pericarditis, myopericarditis. How important is that? If they're both involved, is it okay to just call it myopericarditis, or how do you approach that? What should we say? I don't want to sound stupid when I'm talking to a cardiologist. That's what this is really about.
The terms get a little sloppy. Pericarditis is pretty clear. Myocarditis is excluding the pericardium. When both are involved, you know, some people put the prefix is the one that is less important. So myopericarditis means it's mostly the pericardium that's driving things. And perimyocarditis means it's mostly the myocardium. Honestly, I don't think that matters at all. I think as long as you know that both are involved, I think that's what matters.
Can we get you on record that perimyocarditis is a terrible name? That's just not helpful.
I agree. It kind of sounds like inflammation close to the myocardium. Like
the
know.
Heart may not even necessarily be involved if you're really thinking about it. That could be like inflammation of anything, really. It's not good. Sorry, Matt.
I enjoyed that, Paul. That was good. Can I ask, like, what else are we ordering? Let's say, you know, we have this so far. We have our EKG, we have some of the basic tests. Anything we're missing here, that other serology or things like that you would order in a patient like this?
Again, I think it depends on your pretest probability of what the etiology is. So, you know, this is a person who is otherwise pretty healthy and had a preceding viral syndrome. Mm-hmm. So, you know, chances are extremely high this is from a respiratory viral illness, you know, especially if it's wintertime. You know, you might not do a ton of other workup to look for other etiologies. Things that would make me want to push a little bit harder: symptoms of pericarditis without any preceding viral trigger, recurrent pericarditis, or pericarditis in, you know, maybe certain settings, like in an immunocompromised patient, in somebody with known rheumatologic illness, somebody who has cancer or being treated for cancer. You know, those are unique circumstances.
And I was reading too that it seems like the geography, like if, you know, we're in the New Jersey right now, but if you were in a different area of the world, it changes a little bit what's causing it. So, like we're not thinking tuberculosis if we're seeing somebody here, as at least you might, but it's not as common.
Yeah, you're right. In our part of the world, viral / idiopathic is by far the most common. But in many other parts of the world, tuberculous pericarditis is maybe the most common. Trypanosoma crucii can cause pericarditis. Lyme can cause pericarditis. You know, there's all sorts of other things to look for, but statistically, those are just less common where we are.
Mm.
Is it worth doing sort of at least the knee-jerk testing for, say, HIV or the hepatitis? Like, I feel like that's relatively low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, I mean, I think if the patient has never had those testing in their adult life, they probably need it for that reason anyway. Mm. So, you know, that's fine. But it would be an uncommon initial manifestation of an acute HIV infection or, you know, acute hepatitis infection. So if they've never been tested before, then sure.
Very diplomatic. Thank you.
All right. So for our person, she has a small pericardial effusion. What goes into your calculation about who's safe to send home and who's not?
You know, it's kind of an overall assessment of the patient's stability, to be honest with you. So the pain from pericarditis, you usually don't need to be hospitalized for that. But if you have an effusion, that's where things start to get a little complicated. Effusions can cause pretty significant dyspnea on exertion at the minimum. But then obviously at the most extreme cases can cause tamponade. And there's a spectrum from one to the other. Because pericarditis is usually pretty fast to develop, you don't need a lot of pericardial fluid to cause really bad problems and possibly even tamponade. So, you know, if a patient is very short of breath, can barely get around and do anything, or has evidence of heart failure on exam that I think is related to pericardial effusion, those are reasons to send the patient straight to the hospital. You know, I think there's some argument to be made where if somebody's got a first-time new diagnosis of pericarditis, to have them go to the hospital just mm-hmm. for evaluation to make sure nothing's missed. But certainly the more symptomatic they are with breathing and exercise, the more it looks like they have heart failure, the more aggressive I am.
This also feels like a leading question. And for this case, we have someone who actually has the capacity to POCUS, which is not always the case necessarily, especially in outpatient offices. And I feel like the question is always to echo or not to echo in someone who otherwise looks pretty good. Can you sort of, like, what is the, does everyone who has a presumptive diagnosis or the clinical diagnosis of pericarditis deserve an echocardiogram, and sort of how urgent is that to be done? I know that's, it's going to be a case by case. If they look sick, it's going to matter.
Yeah, I mean, you're asking an echo to person. so I think everybody should get
an
echo.
They have a heartbeat.
You know, in all seriousness, I think it can be difficult sometimes to fully evaluate the hemodynamic consequences of an effusion or of pericarditis without an echo. And especially in young people can fool you. You know, I've seen otherwise healthy 20, 30-year-olds walking around living their life with nearly tamponade. You know, so especially a young person, I would have a pretty low threshold to get an echo.
Yeah. So if we think it would be appropriate, even as an outpatient doc, to order a stat echo to get it, like, pretty quickly, like, we're not waiting a week or two to get an echo in a person like this if they have pericarditis?
I think that's probably appropriate. It depends on the practice environment. You know, if you're in a place where that's easy to facilitate, then great. If you're in a place where it's difficult to facilitate, it might be better to just go to the hospital so that you can get an echo quickly.
One of the articles I was reading said, and I just thought this was a fun fact, you need like 300 mLs or something of a pericardial effusion for it to really make the chest x-ray silhouette big. That seemed like a lot of fluid to be in there. But so just looking at a chest x-ray doesn't tell you for sure there's no pericardial effusion, it seemed.
Yes, that's correct. Looking at a chest x-ray is not going to be enough. And, you know, the pericardium, like you said, maybe around 300, 350 to see it on an x-ray. But if you really have an acute onset effusion, you could get tamponade with 200. So, you know, by the time you see it on the x-ray, it's too late.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's scary. So how would you explain this to this young patient? She's coming in. She's got chest pain. What would it sound like when you explain it to her, like what's going on with the heart? Because I always find this helpful so that next time I see someone with this, I can, you know, explain it to them in a way that they can understand.
Right, because the scenario I'm envisioning, by the way, is like someone comes into resident clinic, they have chest pain, you do an EKG, they have ST elevations, you're like, oh God. And so you're shopping the EKG around other attendings to make sure you're not losing their mind. And then the residents don't want to take a look at it. Meanwhile, this patient has to be losing their mind with their chest pain because they're worried they're having a heart attack. So So I think having an illness script to reassure them would be useful.
So the way I would describe this is I would say that there's inflammation in the lining that's around the heart. And it typically can be caused by a virus. It sounds like you had a cold. It's probably that same virus that did this. Most people who have this get better in a couple weeks, just to sort of lay out what I expect to happen.
This episode is brought to you by Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Irez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Irez, selfishly, it would mean that he could spend more time with Gabby, who is spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There is no training time, no onboarding, and no extra mental burden. All the magic happens in just a few clicks, so clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on doing what they do best. Today, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that does your medical documentation for you. Charting is critical and necessary, but it steals your focus away from your patients, eats away at your time with your family, and keeps you up at night. The burden of always having another chart to complete drains every clinician. Freed is an AI scribe that makes charting go away. It does your SOAP notes for you. Freed listens, prepares your notes, and writes patient instructions. Charting is done before the patient walks out of the room. Freed learns your style over time, just like a human scribe, and it will never quit on you. Freed is loved by over 4,000 clinicians from every specialty. It is HIPAA compliant and takes 30 seconds to learn. And best of all, Freed is only $99 per month. You can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai, and listeners of Curbsiders can use the code CURB50 for $50 off their first month. Our episode today is sponsored by Panacea Financial, a nationwide digital bank built for doctors by doctors. Did you know, according to new research, 19% of residents and fellows work over 80 hours per week? Or that 36% of residents and fellows take on additional work outside of their training programs? Did you know that 54% of residents and fellows rate their financial stress at an 8 or higher out of 10? We all know residents and fellows are an essential part of the U.S. healthcare system, and they endure rigorous training, long hours, and financial strain during this time. Panacea Financial has just released their 2024 Residents and Fellows Survey Report, sharing findings from the experiences of over 600 current residents and fellows. In this report, find an in-depth look at the successes, challenges, and stressors that this group faces and where change is most needed. Download the full report for free at panaceafinancial.com/report. Panacea Financial is a division of Primis, member FDIC.
Are we ready to talk about treatment, Paul, or am I jumping way too far ahead?
Not way too far ahead. I might ask about, so if I were the patient, like you say most patients get better, what happens to the ones who don't, which I guess is my segue into what kind of complications should we be mindful of or counsel patients about if we're being conservative?
You know, it depends on response to therapy, but, you know, acutely speaking, the complications we worry the most about, again, large pericardial effusion, tamponade. Chronically speaking, there's a couple things. Recurrent pericarditis is a real phenomenon where that's mainly a symptomatic problem. The patients just have symptoms that don't go away. They taper their therapy and then symptoms come back. So that can happen. In the very chronic setting, if you have lots and lots of episodes of pericarditis, that can actually cause pericardial constriction. you know, that usually takes a long time to happen, but can happen. In the most extreme cases, you can get acute constrictive pericarditis if the acute episode's that bad. But most of the time, constriction is a longer-term phenomenon. It takes a while.
Okay.
And that's why it's so important to treat people with pericarditis, because if we calm down the inflammation, we drastically reduce the chances of that happening in the future.
What is your go-to first-line regimen for our patient here?
Typically, in somebody who doesn't have a lot of other comorbidities, I think most of us use high-dose NSAIDs. You know, they're easy to get, they're relatively well-tolerated. Mm-hmm. And that is sort of an initial upfront therapy, you know, maybe for about a month to quickly reduce inflammation. And then that's usually combined with colchicine. Colchicine is mainly for prevention. We start it at the same time and then usually continue it for, you know, 6 months, a year, a while.
That seems like it might be hard to tolerate for, like, you're giving them a medicine that can cause ulcers, then you're giving them another medicine that just causes a lot of GI upset. Have you had problems keeping patients adhering to this regimen for as long as they need to?
That's a good question. In the acute setting, I feel like most patients are okay with it. And I think it's probably because they feel so bad from the symptoms of pericarditis that they finally get some relief. Colchicine in the long run can be annoying for people, especially if they have diarrhea. But usually at the doses we're talking about, most people do okay.
Yeah.
Because it's the doses 0.5 milligrams twice a day. Is that?
Yeah, 0.5 or 0.6 twice a day.
Yeah, because I know aspirin is thrown in there too as an alternate, like first line, like the high dose aspirin. And I've seen some people do that. Is it just sort of like a style point, which one you like? It didn't seem to me like there was necessarily evidence one way or the other.
My personal practice is I use high dose aspirin when I cannot use NSAIDs.
Okay.
And so if somebody has, you know, significant kidney issues or GI bleeding that I'm worried the NSAIDs are going to be even worse than the aspirin.
Okay.
Or heart failure, you know, some reason why I'm worried about high dose NSAIDs.
You know, I was always taught don't give steroids, give aspirin or NSAIDs for this. But it seems like in some situations you're still forced to use them.
Yeah, steroids are I would say not first line, but we do use them sometimes. The textbook contraindication is immediate post MI pericarditis, and the data for that is there's an increased risk of rupture of the myocardium. Now, to be fair, that data is pretty old, and we treat MIs a lot differently now, but still for that reason, most of us stay away in that context.
That's when the treatment was like bed rest.
And that's when the watching and hoping was the treatment at that time. Yeah.
Okay.
Just tree finding and therapeutic leashes and stuff, yeah.
All right. What are we up to next here, Paul? We have another part of the case, or are we going to resolve the case? Have we done all the work yet? I mean,
the work is never done, Matt. So I guess in terms of, again, if we're talking about sort of a young, reasonably healthy patient who does not have a gigantic effusion and just kind of feels crummy, in terms of activity counseling, that kind of thing, like what do you tell these patients they can or can't do? I feel like it's always a consideration for someone who's having chest pain and sort of cardiac symptoms. What sort of counseling can we give the patients?
I typically will tell patients to not engage in a lot of, you know, heavy physical exertion for at least the time that they're on the NSAIDs, which on average is, you know, a couple of weeks or a month or something like that. I can't say there's a tremendous amount of data to support what I just said, but people usually don't feel that great during that time anyway. So they're not thrilled about it.
So they're not out doing wind sprints anyway.
Usually not. And then, you know, once they come off the NSAIDs and they're just on the colchicine, there it gets a lot hazier what you should advise people to do. You know, I think it also depends on what kind of activity they're doing, you know, or it depends, are they a professional athlete and they have to get back to what they do? And I think that's more of an individual decision.
Yeah, that does sound murky. The risk of recurrence, I imagine some of it's just bad luck, but is it, if someone goes through the colchicine 3 to 6 months of that and stops, is that pretty effective? Or are you seeing a lot of cases of this? This is something that's not really on my radar as a primary care. Like, I don't have a ton of people in my panel with recurrent pericarditis, thankfully.
I would say most people get better and symptoms go away. But again, it depends on the etiology. I think most pericarditis is probably viral, mm-hmm. but there is some underlying genetic predisposition that we don't fully understand. And I think some of those people may be at risk for recurrent episodes for that reason. Also, you know, if pericarditis is related to rheumatologic illnesses or infections, that can also cause that.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that I was reading is that if if it doesn't get better as you would expect, then you should start thinking about like a secondary cause of pericarditis. Like, could this person have a malignant effusion or some infection that you were missing? I'm not sure if that's your practice to like, if they don't get better, just to start digging in more and doing more of a workup.
Yeah, I would do the same. Again, you know, most people have a pretty clear viral prodrome. They're otherwise healthy. But if everything doesn't add up cleanly and they're not getting better quickly, I am pretty aggressive about looking for causes, especially because, like we said, leaving them with inflammation that's uncontrolled can have a lot of problems in the long run. There's some new agents out there for recurrent pericarditis, some biologic drugs that were heavily marketed at a recent national cardiology conference. But there's data for some of these things, but the patient population we're talking about here is very narrow. This is idiopathic recurrent pericarditis. Most people with recurrent pericarditis have it for a reason, like they have cancer, they have, you know, an infection or something else.
Yeah. Okay. So we don't need to plug those pharmaceuticals there.
Yeah. They'll be direct to consumer marketing, I'm sure.
Yeah.
The four people it applies to.
Yeah. Okay. Let's resolve this. Let's say our patient takes first line therapy, completes her colchicine, deals with the diarrhea, and then she's back to exercising in 3 to 4 months or so, and we've cured her, Paul. So I think we should go on to another case.
Okay. We are going to pivot to a 45-year-old gentleman with hypertension who presents to the emergency department with 1 to 2 weeks of feeling just kind of crummy. He's been having general malaise, low-grade fevers, some shortness of breath, and intermittent non-exertional dull chest pain. He's had a couple of palpitations, but they go away after a minute or two, and he has not lost consciousness. He takes lisinopril and HCTZ regularly, and he's tried acetaminophen and ibuprofen for the past few days, but they haven't really helped his chest pain much. On examination, he's got a heart rate of 90. His blood pressure is 99 over 65, which is a little bit lower than his norm. His breathing appears slightly labored. Our excellent cardiac examination is regular without murmurs, and he has 1+ pitting edema bilaterally. His EKG shows sinus rhythm with nonspecific ST changes, and the ED calls you specifically, because they're not going to be calling me for this, when his high-sensitivity troponin comes back elevated at 460. So before we get to the specific diagnosis, you have this patient who has really weeks worth of feeling kind of crummy with this fairly elevated troponin. So I guess, you know, could you just talk us through your general differential diagnosis and how you'd approach initially, and then we can kind of narrow things down a little bit.
Sure. You know, I think in general, whenever someone has an elevated troponin, we, and by we, I mean the fellows, get this consult all the time. I think that, you know, an overarching framework that I think about is it due to acute ischemia, acute coronary syndrome? Is it due to type 2 MI from some reason or other, global supply-demand mismatch? Or is it due to some sort of non-ischemic myocardial injury? And, you know, there's a number of different things that fall into that bucket. So I try to go through those things in my head. In this particular case, you know, this is a 45-year-old man with hypertension. So he does have some risk factors for having coronary disease. I mean, so that's something that we can't forget about. But some of the symptoms he's describing, like general malaise, fevers, dull chest pain for 2 weeks, you know, these are not typical symptoms of ischemia. So I would still be thinking pretty broadly at this point. I don't think that just based on history and ECG troponin alone, I don't think anything has been excluded yet.
Yeah. So like, what's a typical case? I know, again, they're not super common, but or maybe they are in your world, but for myocarditis, like what makes you start to think down that pathway, that line of thinking?
Well, a couple things. Again, many causes of myocarditis are preceded by some sort of viral syndrome or inflammatory trigger like a vaccine. So if a patient has a couple weeks of low-grade fevers and URI symptoms, that certainly makes you think about that. The evidence of heart failure on exam, so he has some pitting edema, that also makes you start to wonder, could there be something affecting the heart? Elevated troponins, you know, are not specific for myocarditis, but suggest that there is some ongoing myocardial damage, especially if the on serial troponins, it doesn't look like a rise and fall of an MI. It looks kind of like smoldering elevated troponin. That, at least to me, is more suggestive of inflammation rather than ischemia or infarction. So this is definitely a case that makes me think of myocarditis, independent of the topic that I know.
And I realized we were rude not to include the JVP exam for you. And then, especially since the next part that Paul is going to read goes right to a POCUS. So, Paul, do you want to go to the next part?
Skip right past the examination.
Yeah.
So we pull out our handy pocket ultrasound. We performed a bedside TT, which show moderate LV hypokinesis. The EF is around 40 to 45%, so not normal, subnormal. And there's a small pericardial effusion. So with that information, does that change anything for you? Does that narrow things down? You know, where do we take it from here?
I would say still nothing is excluded. The pattern of hypokinesis in the LV matters a little bit. If it's very regional in one anatomic territory, that might make me think a little more of coronary disease. Whereas if it's global, that might make me think of something else. But none of those things are specific at this point. What I do know from this, the EF is reduced in an otherwise young, healthy person. So something serious is happening. And there is also a small pericardial effusion, meaning whatever process is happening is probably also affecting the pericardium. So that makes me think a little more of perimyocarditis or whatever we're going to call it.
I thought we banned that term in this podcast.
I wouldn't say anything is excluded yet, but it's sort of moving in that direction.
Yeah. So it sounds like, do a lot of these people end up getting the full like left heart cath ischemic workup when they're presenting this way, since it can be hard to differentiate the two?
Yeah, I think the majority of people with myocarditis, in order to be confident in that diagnosis that there's nothing else going on, you have to really make sure there's no active coronary disease. It depends a little on the person and the presentation. Like if it's a 20-year-old person with fulminant, cardiogenic shock and VT storm, then the chances of coronary disease are very low. But in anyone of this age, I think you really have to be sure.
Yeah, I've been sort of lightly obsessing about this case because I could see someone like this coming in and they even undergo the ischemic evaluation and then they would get sort of the blanket diagnosis of a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy. And then I feel like you'd kind of be done. Like, you'd sort of start treating with guideline-directed medical therapy. So I guess who, to your mind, sort of warrants the more aggressive investigations? Who's getting things like cardiac MRs or endomyocardial biopsies or that kind of thing? Like, what's your approach to actually work up the myocarditis if that's what your suspicion is? And who needs the really the full court press and who is just sort of treated for their symptoms?
I would say one feature of this case that makes me want to do the full court press is the history of sort of fevers and general malaise for a couple weeks. That suggests some sort of inflammatory process in the body at large. And we often see that in someone who gets an inflammatory myocarditis. The other thing is the troponin elevation. So troponin elevation, again, not specific for anything, but if we exclude coronary disease and we exclude type 2 MIs based on what's happening clinically, then something is happening to cause that elevated troponin and we need to find out what it is. Increasingly nowadays, the test of choice for evaluation, if you get an echo and it looks like this and you get a cath and there's no coronary disease, the test of choice would be a cardiac MRI. Cardiac MRI is very, very good for not only imaging the myocardium, characterizing the tissue, quantifying the EF, but specifically looking for myocardial inflammation in a way that other tests really cannot do. And so this person definitely meets my threshold where I would look to get a cardiac MRI. Mm.
And for the definitive diagnosis, can you make it with just the clinical picture and the cardiac MR? Like, how many of these patients need a biopsy to definitively prove that that's what this is?
It's a good question. I would say that most patients with myocarditis generally don't need biopsies. They have the right clinical syndrome. They've got the right lab findings. They have an MRI that is consistent with patchy myocardial inflammation or edema. Myocardial biopsy, I think, is really most useful in a couple of cases. Number one is a case where all the data doesn't add up and you really don't know what's going on. But I think the more important one than that is a patient who comes in really sick. And in cardiology world, we call that fulminant myocarditis. That's often somebody who comes in with ventricular arrhythmias, heart block, cardiogenic shock, cardiac arrest even in the most extreme cases. I think those are the cases where early myocardial biopsy can make a difference. And the reason is there are certain diagnoses you would see on biopsy that you would treat them differently immediately. And that's especially important with these sort of crash and burn fulminant cases. In a case like this, I think probably an MRI would be sufficient.
Yeah, because they're not that sick, so you have a little more time and to figure things out. And I guess I imagine there's some complications of an endomyocardial biopsy that you're trying to avoid.
Yeah, depending on which study you believe, the risk of perforating the heart on a myocardial biopsy is approximately 1%, which doesn't sound very high, but the complication is quite serious. So
yeah,
it sounds bad.
Yeah,
I'm not a cardiologist.
Complication is impending death.
Yeah. Like, so if you can make a convincing diagnosis without needing to do that, then that's better. But again, especially in the cases of fulminant myocarditis, where people come in going from normal to crash and burn within a day, those people really should get biopsied to look for specific diagnoses.
And this kind of feeds into one of the many areas of this where I struggle, but, you know, what is, I've seen a million different frameworks and sort of categories for how what we're calling the cause of myocarditis, whether they're high risk versus low risk or what the background etiology is. Like, could you talk us through, like, how you classify and what your framework is for the myocarditis? Like, I don't have any kind of way to kind of grab hold of it.
Yeah, there are a number of different things that cause myocarditis. I would say it is inflammation of the myocardium. So sometimes you can see it in chronic inflammatory illnesses, rheumatologic illnesses, sarcoidosis. Those are on the list. Acute inflammatory things, and so that could be an infection with a virus most commonly, but can be infections with other things. Again, Lyme can do it. Various parasites can do it. It can be an acute inflammatory stimulus without an infection, like a vaccine. That's pretty well documented. Medications can cause myocarditis. There's a lot of them that have been reported. I would say nowadays the ones that we're seeing most commonly is drugs for cancer. And there are certain types of cancer drugs that are well known to cause myocarditis.
The checkpoint inhibitors.
Checkpoint inhibitors are the main group that we know to do that. And I think that's sort of a broad overview of the things that someone can walk in with. Now, there's also causes of myocarditis and pericarditis that result from things we have done. So either post-cardiac surgery, post-EP procedure, that can cause inflammation of the pericardium or myocardium. Usually we know if the patient has had that done, but, you know.
All right. So due to suspicion of myocarditis, he does undergo a cardiac MR, which shows LV dysfunction and regional myocardial edema consistent with acute myocarditis. We've kind of gone through the major causes here. So you mentioned vaccines. I know this is a hot topic here. How do you counsel patients about that? Or I'm sure you have like family, friends and things asking like, should I get a vaccine because I'm worried about myocarditis?
It's a good question. There definitely is a signal that mRNA vaccines for COVID increase the incidence of myocarditis. The amount of the increase is relatively small. And the counseling that I give to patients is that there is a much higher chance of getting myocarditis from infection with COVID than from vaccine with COVID, or than from COVID vaccine. And those of us in cardiology have seen many, many, many people get myocarditis in the last couple of years as a consequence of a COVID infection. So that's the counseling I give. Obviously, I still recommend people be vaccinated, but you know, there are those rare cases where they do develop it after a vaccine without an infection. It does happen.
There was one article I saw that was just saying that when they looked at, I think it was a UK study, and it was like 43 million people or something, and they looked at it by like subgroups, and some of the young men under 40, they seem to have the higher risk or the equivalent risk from either infection or the vaccine to get myocarditis. So, you know, that's one group I might have a different calculus in, but I don't know what your thoughts are.
No, I mean, you're right that subset of young males is the group that has a slightly higher incidence. What do you do with that information? It's at this point, it's almost a moot point now because so many people have already been either infected with or vaccinated from COVID. You know, in the beginning part of the pandemic, I think it was a much harder decision to counsel people on.
Yeah.
Now, you know, most people have not lived their whole life now unexposed to COVID antigen.
Yes. And that's a good point too, because that study, the patients were vaccinated like between 2020 and 20, it was very early on. So it was like totally different virus that was around. And
typically most people, after the second vaccination, which again, that ship has sailed for, I think, like the vast majority of people at this point.
So most people have had the initial series, or they've had a COVID infection, or they've had initial series plus booster. So I think it's still a little confusing. But like you said, and viruses can give you a myocarditis, and I don't know if that was helpful for, I don't know if that was helpful, but.
A lot of words though, so that's good. This episode is brought to you by Factor. Listen, if you're listening to this, you're probably a busy person. You're out there, you're saving lives. You're refilling nasal spray. You're probably doing a lot of typing, one has to imagine. And when you're as busy as people like us are, sometimes you don't have the time or the energy to meal prep for the week. Maybe when you get home, you just don't want to put together a whole meal, and it would just like be able to have something that is tasty put together fast. Which is why I'm happy to tell you about Factor. Factor features fresh, never frozen meals. Each of them are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. Factor features over 35 different options to choose from every week that includes Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. And there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. Factor features two-minute meals. You can fuel up fast with Factor's restaurant-quality meals that are ready to heat and eat wherever you are. Factor features pancakes, smoothies, and more. You can discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day, like breakfast, midday bites, and more. Factor's meals are ready to heat and eat, so there's no prepping, cooking, or cleanup needed. And they are flexible for your schedule. You can get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. And you can always pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. Sign up and save. We've done the math. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. Head to factormeals.com/curb50 and use code curb50 to get 50% off. That's code curb50 at factormeals.com/curb50 to get 50% off.
So we talked about a lot of the causes. We talked about the, you know, if someone comes in with a fulminant picture or really crazy arrhythmias or cardiac arrest, we're going to be more aggressive about getting a biopsy to try to figure out the cause because it might affect treatment. And we mentioned certain meds like the checkpoint inhibitors can cause this. What other additional workup might you think about if you besides the cardiac MR and maybe an endomyocardial biopsy, anything else that you're routinely doing?
I guess a couple of other thoughts. I think for the person who doesn't have fulminant myocarditis, because that's a separate case, you know, again, you may want to look for rheumatologic illnesses or, you know, malignancies if they don't have a convincing viral prodrome beforehand,
yeah,
or a convincing, vaccine exposure or something. You may want to go looking for those. Mm-hmm.
It seems like Lyme would be reasonable. We're in the Northeast here.
Lyme is reasonable. You know, most people who get Lyme carditis do not get the kind of myocarditis that looks like this.
That looks like this. Okay.
Most people get conduction disease and heart block, but it happens. So, you know, testing for Lyme is reasonable, especially in the right time of year.
Mm-hmm.
I think, a couple other points about fulminant myocarditis that, the conditions that we look for where it would, things would change very suddenly if you knew the diagnosis are giant cell myocarditis and eosinophilic myocarditis, because those both respond to very high-dose pulse steroids. So getting a biopsy is important for those. And then one other thing that we think about a lot, if someone does come in that circumstance, escalating care quickly is very, very important, because those people can go from wide awake talking to you to not alive anymore in a day. And so often that means quickly bringing them to a unit or quickly doing a cath or transferring them to a transplant center. You know, those things may have to happen very, very fast for someone with fulminant myocarditis.
This is probably going to be hard to answer, so you're welcome in advance. But in terms of general management principles, like I realize it's going to depend on sort of how sick the patient is and what the underlying etiology, but in general for myocarditis, or how are there any sort of general principles that we should bear in mind when managing these patients?
It is a broad question.
I warned you.
I think it depends on what kind of presentation the patient has. So, like this patient, his presentation is primarily heart failure. And so the treatment is primarily going to be treatment for heart failure, you know, diuretics and appropriate guideline therapy for reduced CF, et cetera. Some people, their presentation is primarily arrhythmias. And so for those people, you may think more about antiarrhythmic therapy up front. For others, like we said, their presentation is very severe cardiogenic shock. Those people may need early mechanical circulatory support. You know, the other question that comes up in these patients is immunosuppressive therapy and who needs immunosuppressive therapy when. There's no great randomized trials for any of this, but I think generally speaking, the sicker the patient, the more you should immunosuppress them. And so, you know, we tend not to give immunosuppressive medicines like steroids or anything else if somebody just has a little bit of mild heart failure. Whereas if someone comes in shock or cardiac arrest or refractory arrhythmias, those people get pretty aggressive immunosuppression.
I think I think it's hard to get a little more specific than that. I just know we recently did another show on another cardiac amyloidosis, which I was not familiar with, but they were just mentioning that the guideline-directed medical therapy in those patients is really, you have to be careful how you apply it because they may not respond well. For patients with myocarditis, is it pretty similar to just treating anyone else with systolic heart failure when you're adjusting those medications?
I think we all act like it's similar. Again, with the exception of fulminant myocarditis, I think most of us will treat cardiomyopathy due to myocarditis in a roughly similar way, mm-hmm. Acknowledging that the trials that had studied these medicines included zero people with myocarditis.
Right.
So, we're all kind of making it up. But in general, I think most of us will still take that same approach.
Yeah. So what about placing a defibrillator in a patient like this? How often is that happening? Is that for people who declare themselves with arrhythmias? How is that approached?
I think I would think about it in two ways. If somebody doesn't have arrhythmias, I think the same sort of standard heart failure rules apply,
okay.
Which is, your EF has to be less than a certain amount and you have to be on guideline-directed therapy for a certain amount of time, et cetera. If you have a lot of arrhythmias, then I think a defibrillator is reasonable, but often those are the same people where we're giving them very aggressive immunosuppressive medicines. And so if you can calm down their inflammation enough to get rid of their arrhythmia, they may not need a defibrillator anymore. So it kind of depends on how they present.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's not helpful, but I've seen cases of checkpoint inhibitor myocarditis where the patients come in with a lot of ventricular ectopy and VT, but by withdrawing the checkpoint inhibitor and giving pulse dose of steroids, their arrhythmia quiets down very quickly. It's not clear that that person needs a defibrillator in an ongoing way, in the same way that somebody with longstanding cardiomyopathy does. Again, there's no data studying defibrillators in these people in a randomized way, so hard to say.
So, Paul, we have America's primary care physician here, and presumably, once we treat this patient, they might go back to see Paul. What sort of things might Paul be following up? What's the next couple months look like for this person? How do you counsel them?
Long-term follow-up of myocarditis, assuming you haven't made any new diagnosis like cancer or rheumatoid arthritis or something, treatment of heart failure is still probably going to be the mainstay. So mm-hmm. getting them on the right meds, making sure they're euvolemic. I think, there is an increasing movement to sort of monitor inflammation in an ongoing way. What does that mean? Checking troponins is an easy way to do that. It's cheap and easy to get. It's one of the few circumstances where I think an outpatient check of a troponin actually makes sense.
I usually try never to do that.
It's like an outpatient D-dimer. I don't have any interest in it.
And then, I think there can be a role for serial MRIs in the right person. The changes of myocarditis may take months to go away, maybe a year. So, you're not gonna get it that fast, but maybe 3-6 months down the line, you might think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as the patient feels better, often they may, depending on who they are, they may want to start doing things. So, an issue that has come up before is, well, what if you have a young man who gets myocarditis after a vaccine? When can this person go back to athletic activity, or when can they start living their life again? There aren't really great guidelines for that, but I think many of us look at monitoring of inflammation as a way to give us a little bit of guidance.
Mm-hmm. And the concern is that they'll make the inflammation worse if they start exercising too soon and progress in their cardiomyopathy.
Yeah, so one concern is that by putting more demand on the heart, you may worsen the inflammation and then worsen the heart failure. The other concern, I guess, would be arrhythmias, that we know that, people with myocardial inflammation are at higher risk of arrhythmia even at rest. So then if you put them under conditions of stress, they may have arrhythmias that may come without warning and may be fatal. So, I think there is an appropriate hesitation to allow people to go back to that kind of activity. That was a big controversy recently, again, related to the COVID vaccines. So I don't think there's been a great resolution of that. Different people have different opinions about what should or should not be done. But I don't think there's a consensus among cardiologists.
Boy, I hope I never get this, Paul, because if you think I'm crazy now, if I couldn't exercise for 3 to 6 months, I would be...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it would be very bad.
It'd be bad.
Okay.
Are the pathologic changes that would lead to the heart failure type symptoms, in most cases, are those irreversible? Like, I guess, it's because we have a known precipitant here. Are there ever instances where you might de-escalate the guideline-directed therapy, or is this something that they're... Like most cases of systolic dysfunction, you're just sort of treating in perpetuity.
hopefully, most cases of myocarditis, the dysfunction is reversible. Hopefully, if it's just edema and not yet scar, then you can control the edema and then it gets better. But you never know. And if somebody's on guideline-directed therapy, I'll almost never stop someone's guideline-directed therapy. You know, I think that unless they're having side effects from it, I think it would be hard for me to justify doing that. You know, again, there's these rare cases of like a 20-something-year-old who feels like $1 million now. You know, that would be a discussion, but it would never be my blanket recommendation that you're allowed to stop after a certain amount of time. But if the patient twists my arm about it, you know, we can have a conversation.
Okay. Should we take a few audience questions? I think we're probably at that point. So does anybody have any questions for Vivek about, yes? Oh, that's a tough question. Okay, so the question, I'm glad that's not for me. The question is, after a cardiac surgery and someone's having some like arrhythmias or just symptoms, how do you know what's a graft problem and what might be myocarditis?
Or pericarditis.
Pericarditis, sorry.
You know, it's after you cut the pericardium, like it's kind of by definition pericarditis. Like they're going to have inflammation there. And so then the question that we often ask ourselves when we think about treating it is, does the patient feel anything? Because having some sort of subclinical inflammation after cardiac surgery, basically everybody has that. But if they don't, you know, if it doesn't bother them, that's not a big deal. But often people will have symptoms of pericarditis and they'll specifically describe that it's worse with laying back. And those are the people we treat them a little more aggressively for pericarditis. The same is true often after EP procedures. That depending on the procedure that's done, you know, the procedure kind of has to involve inflammation in the area. So it's not uncommon for people to get subclinical inflammation, but then we treat them if they have symptoms, basically. Pericarditis treatment is generally speaking, driven a lot by symptoms.
Any other audience questions? Yes. So this question is about, do steroids seem to cause recurrent pericarditis? That was something, you know, that I remember reading that as well.
That's a good question. I don't know the latest data of whether that's still thought to be true now. I would say that practically speaking, many of us will avoid steroids, even just for other reasons, for the toxicities they have. And so if you're left in a scenario where you have to use steroids, they probably have recurrent pericarditis anyway. But that is why these new agents are being investigated, to try to avoid the need for long-term steroids in those patients. Mm-hmm. It's a tricky situation when it happens.
Any other questions? Okay, let's give a round of applause for our guest.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you so much.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Okay, I was hoping for an audience cheer, but no. All right, that's fine. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon, get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. It also helps a lot when you subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME through VCU at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. A special thanks to Dr. Vivek Kulkarni again for being our guest on this episode, and to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Man Chew moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
That's a strong word. And as always, I'm Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thanks and goodbye.